So what I have to offer you, I'm guessing, is really just more of what you're already doing. Because if you weren't already doing it so well, I wouldn't be experiencing what I just described. I want to talk a little bit about psychology called attachment theory that has been very, very meaningful to me on a personal level in my life. And I think it's a very important theory or set of ideas to be aware of as parents in our own personal relationships with our spouses, at work, with our friends, and obviously gearing it in this context a little bit more directly to parenting. And the way that I like to introduce attachment theory is actually by looking at a different theory for a moment and using it kind of as a foil or a contrast. So on the page in front of you, the page that had the triangle on the top, if you think of that page, I figured we're in a school, so I need to give you like a lot of handouts, maybe be like students. Apparently, I was on target because apparently they sent you an email that this was like mandatory. So you guys are really being put back in high school over here, and we are taking attendance and marking late, and only one person can go to the bathroom at a time, so please raise your hand. The triangle in front of you is a depiction of what's called Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Abraham Maslow is a well-known psychologist, and he developed the theories that does have a lot of truth to it, although I'm going to poke some holes in it right now. Maslow's hierarchy of needs essentially makes the claim that human development and human needs happen in a hierarchy across. So what he says is that we have a basic level of needs, and that's how we start off as humans, with needing to meet those basic needs. When we've met those basic needs, we can then look to meet the next level of needs. When we meet those, we can then move to the next, and so on and so forth. In addition to saying that there's that process of that hierarchy, he also then describes what he thinks each of those levels of needs are. Now, he tells you specifically what the basic level needs are, what the next level, and the next. And the way that Maslow describes it is that he says, as you see on the illustration in front of you, is that the basic level of needs that we have is what he calls our basic needs, is physiological needs, such as food, water, warmth, shelter, physical safety, in that sense. That is the basic level of need that he says we have. It's our first initial level of need as a human being. When that's been met, we can then go on to look for our relationship needs, our needs to connect with other people, and our need to develop self-esteem. From there, when you've now met that middle level of need, you can then move to what he calls the highest level of needs, which are what he calls self-actualization. Be able to manifest and actualize your creativity, your ideas, to download, so to speak, what you have inside into the world and to allow it to be. That's your self-actualization. Attachment theory came and pointed out that Maslow's hierarchy is fundamentally flawed in two ways. It's flawed both on the bottom and on the top. And I want to share both of these with you to describe a little bit what attachment theory is and to try and describe why it's so important to be conscious of it, to live with. The hierarchy is flawed on the bottom because in the hierarchy that Maslow presents, it makes it seem as if you have a basic need of food and shelter and safety, and that if that's met, you can survive. You may not thrive, but you can survive. If you have those basic needs, you will be physically okay. What the research has shown, I'm not going to take you through all of it right now, but in a variety of different ways that the research has shown, is that that's actually not true. That if a person has food, shelter, warmth, etc., they actually physically cannot survive. I don't mean emotionally, spiritually, in their highest, I mean physically, they cannot survive. The physical human being, the physical body, is not okay when it's only nourished physically. There's a basic level needed called connection to other humans. There's a basic level need, not a next level need. It is an essential need that is as basic as having food and water. And that without having relationship, without having a sense that there's someone in the world that cares about my existence, that my being here is seen and known by another person, and that I'm living my life in this world in a shared experience, if I don't have that, I can have shelter, warmth, safety, food, and water, and I will still not survive. Medically, this was a medical mystery for a number of years called failure to thrive, that attachment theory came and kind of solved this mystery. The Maslow's hierarchy of needs makes it seem as if relationship, the kind of this secondary in-between next level need. What attachment theory came and said is, it's a basic level need. It's a most primary basic level need. They actually wanted to call attachment theory initially love theory, because that's really what it is. There's nothing complex about this. There's no sophisticated idea. I mean, there are some as we get further into it, but on this basic level, what they're really saying is that the human being needs love as much as the human being needs. And you can't survive without food. You can't survive without love. They didn't call it love theory because they thought they'd get laughed out of the scientific world, which, by the way, they did even when they called it attachment theory. John Bowlby, who initially started attachment theory, he was completely, you know, just mocked in the beginning when he presented these ideas. We take some of these things for granted, but these are ideas that in the beginning were revolutionary. It wasn't so long ago that they didn't let parents into hospitals with their children for very long. Attachment theory is what changed that, because you can't survive if you don't have loving life. So then they wanted to call it relationship theory, but they thought that still didn't sound technical enough, so they called it attachment theory. But attachment theory really is just a word that used attachment to mean connection, to mean relationship, and to mean love. So that's how attachment theory is flawed on the bottom. Attachment theory is also flawed, excuse me, that's how Maslow's hierarchy is flawed on the bottom. It's also flawed on the top. Because the way that the hierarchy that Maslow presents makes it seem is as if your ultimate happiness, your ultimate self-actualization at the top of the pyramid, when you climb all the way to the top of the ladder, where are you trying to get to? What you're trying to get to is what is depicted in this way of self-actualization in a way that seems and feels and looks very individualized. Like, I'm going to manifest my ideas into the world. What, again, what all the research has shown over the past number of years is that people who self-actualize, even to the maximum, they have the most self-actualization. They've been able to manifest all their creativity into the world successfully. If they're not doing that in a shared experience with someone else, if they're doing it just on their own in an isolated experience of self-actualization, it's meaningless to them. It's a miserable experience. In some ways, it's actually worse than not self-actualizing. Because then the experience is like, I'm self-actualizing. Look at all the things I'm doing. Why is there no one here to share? Right? I'm a big sports fan. And despite being like such a big sports fan, I guess I'm really also the softy. Because as much as I love sports, my favorite moment in sports is when the game ends and you see all the spouses and the children of the players run onto the field and embrace their loved ones. That's like my favorite part of sports. It's kind of embarrassing to admit, but it is what it is. What can I do? Because that's the point here. The self-actualization of winning the World Series, of winning Super Bowl, which is this incredible self-actualization. But if you don't have anyone running onto the field with you, it's almost worse than not winning. But right now, someone should be running onto the field. But when you have someone running onto the field to embrace you in that moment, that's powerful. It's fireworks. It's sublime. It's almost otherworldly. Because what attachment theory has shown is that what needs to change about this hierarchy of needs, this pyramid, is that actually love and relationship needs to be accompanying every level of it. There's no level that doesn't have it. Relationships are not just a means to an end. It's not just, okay, I have my physical needs, and then I want to self-actualize. In between there somewhere, I need some support from a few people. That's not the way a human being functions. Human being functions that are most essential, basic, and our loftiest need is relationships. There's an amazing expression of this in our Torah sources. There's a famous tradition we have that says, "Ba'asara ma'amarot nivraha olam." The world was created in 10 utterances, 10 acts of speech. That God, we know, created the world in Bereshit. He created with speech. "Vayomer Elokim, yihi or, let there be light." "Vayihi or, there was light," is through speech. The problem that Chazal have is that if you count the amount of "Vayomer Elokims" in Bereshit, you have not 10, but 9. So why do we have a tradition that says that it's 10 acts of speech? So there's a few different answers to this question, but to one answer that's just incredible. One answer says that you look at a point in the Torah where you would have thought creation was over. Typically, the way to read it is creation has ended. Hashem creates man, Adam, and you would think creation's over. And then it says, "Vayomer Elokim, lo tov heyot ha'adam levado," not good for a person to be alone. Now, typically the way we read this text is creation's over, and now God is making almost, so to speak, like an observation. It's like a commentary on creation. "By the way, I've created this world. I'm now realizing and pointing out it's not good for a human to be alone, therefore I'm making a partner for him." But what this opinion is saying is that that's not how to read this text. The way to read it is that when God says it's not good to be alone, that's an act of creation. Part of the very fabric of our reality, part of the existence that we live in, is that we need connection. It's not an additional thing. It's not a side point. It's not something extra. It's part of the very essence of our need to exist. That's the basic idea of attachment theory that I want to share with you, because I think on the one hand, we all know this, and yet at the same time as knowing it, the question is, how much do we live it? We need constant reminders, because it's very hard sometimes to live this when we live in a very fast-paced and busy world where we're pulled in so many directions all the time. So that's the basic kind of first layer of what attachment theory is about. This need for connection, this need for relationship, the need to live life in a shared experience. The question then is, how do we provide that for our children? Which is easier said than done. So I want to share with you a little bit about what attachment theory says and how we can try and do the best job that we possibly can. And they introduce this through the next chapter, so to speak, of attachment theory, which is called attachment styles. So in attachment styles, the idea is like this. Just like you can have a artist, painter, who paints dozens, hundreds of paintings over the course of their life, of their career, and each painting is going to be different, going to look entirely different. But someone who knows that painter well can see a painting that they've never seen before and think to themselves, oh, this is that painter. Because a painter has a style, even if every particular painting is different. Similar with a musician or a sports player. Every game they play is different, but they have a certain style of how they play. What attachment theory suggests is that we all have a style in which we engage relationships. So even if every relationship we have is different, when I engage with students here, when I go back home, I engage with my children, my spouse, when I meet with my clients, when I talk to my friends, these are all going to be different relationships. They're going to have different particulars, different content. But the dynamic, the phenomenon, the structure, the way, the style that I engage those relationships will be consistent throughout all the relationships. And what attachment theory says is that there's three basic styles. Of course, each of us is different. So for however many human beings there are in the world, that's how many attachment styles exist. But there are three basic, or kind of four, we'll get to that soon, three or four basic templates or styles of relationship. The first is what they call secure attachment style. Secure attachment style is obviously what we hope for. That's the optimal attachment style. Secure attachment style comes from having the experience from the earliest ages. By the way, attachment styles, the research says, are typically developed between the ages of 0 and 3 and then last for the rest of your life. Primarily from the way that your primary caregiver is related to you between the age of 0 and 3. When you have caregivers and you have parents or whoever the caregivers are that are present but not overly present, that see you but see you, not themselves in you, that are there for you but not overbearing to you, that allow you to have mistakes, that allow you to struggle, that also pick you up and prop you up and help you and provide that balanced way of being present as a parent or as a caregiver, that creates a person who's able to have a secure attachment style. So on the sheet, not the triangle one, the other one, I have for you here something called the Olsen Circumflex Model of Family Systems. That's a mouthful. Olsen, someone named David Olsen, developed a theory called the Circumflex Model of Family System. And I think it's very, very interesting. What he talks about is two different aspects of family systems. One aspect is how present are the people in the family to each other. How engaged are they? On one side of the spectrum, you'll have enmeshed family systems, people that are overly present, overbearing in a way. And then on the other side of that, you'll have a neglected family system, that disengaged, that the people are not present at all. So that's one aspect, that's one variable. And that's the top, what he has here, disengaged, separated, connected, and enmeshed. The second variable, he calls adaptability, but I like to think about it as rules or expectation. How structured is the environment? which if you think about it is a different variable than how present people are. What are the expectations? Are there very rigid or specific expectations? You are supposed to go to an Ivy League college. That's the expectation. Now, that's a very different question than am I present in your life? I might never be home from work. Two different variables, right? You are supposed to be on the soccer team. Like, that's just an expect. In our family, you're on the soccer team. That's how it goes, right? That's a different question from am I around all the time? Am I available to help you with your homework? So the left side variable, the vertical one, is chaotic, meaning there's zero rule, zero expectations. You can do your homework or not do your homework. You can eat whatever you want for dinner. You can go to sleep whatever time you want. You can go to class or not go to class. There's just no structure to the environment, no expectations, no rule. Then you have flexible, which is more rules but with more flexibility. Structured, which is high levels of expectations and structure, but not totally locked in. And then you have rigid, where we have very particular, like the lane that you can work in is this narrow, and that's rigid. Okay? So these are the two different variables that make up family systems. Very interesting to think about. Where are you? Where is your family? What is your parenting style? In both of these regards, right? How present are you or disengaged? Are you more present or giving more space? That's one question. Second question, what are the type of expectations or rules or structure that you have in your household? What Olson then says is that interaction between these two different variables is very, very powerful. Because if you combine any combination of the two extremes, you set up a pretty dangerous environment for a child to grow up in. So if you combine the middles of both, you're in the sweet zone. There's no exact way to be. There's not only one right or good way of parenting. There's a range, and there's a lot of different ways to be good parents. So it's not about hitting an exact specific way, but anything in the middle. So what that means is that on the cohesion level, variable or axis, you have anywhere from separated to connected, anywhere in that spectrum, combined with the adaptability variable of anywhere from flexible to structured. That combination is a very positive combination for a child to grow up in. My parents are present and they're open to who I am as a person. That's a beautiful environment to grow up in. My parents are present to me. They're available to me. They want to be here for me. If I need them, they're here. Some parents will be more present in that way. Some will be more disengaged, but they're present. They're available. They're in my life. They know what's going on in my life. I get home from school and they ask me questions. They check in. They know what I'm up to. They know what classes I'm in. Some will know detail. Some will know a lot and some will know much less, but there's an availability. There's a presence. There's an engagement. There's some level of relationship that's taking place. And that level of engagement is not coming with totally not caring in the sense that whatever you answer doesn't matter to me. You can answer anything. You can tell me anything. It doesn't make a difference to me. I ask you how your day was and you say, you know, it was great. I went out in the middle of school to cut class and the parents don't care at all. So now you're available, but there's a sense that what I do doesn't matter in any direction. I could have told you about being a jerk to my friend and you would just say, that's all good. I love you. That's great. And now, what I do doesn't matter. I'll get the sense that my actions actually have weight, that they have significance to me. So you're present, but I don't get the sense or the perception that my actions matter. On the flip side, you can be present, but if there's the rigidity that I have very little room to work with, then the impression I get is that your presence is not about caring about me. Your presence is because you are trying to make me into what you want. So if you have this narrow range of expectations of what it means to be successful in life, then when you are present, you can be present as a parent, but the perception the child is developing is your presence is not because your presence to me being me, you're present so that you can impose what you want upon me. However, in the more positive way, if you have that middle range of presence with a middle range of expectations, that's a beautiful experience. Because now the child feels that you're available for me. What I do does matter. What I tell you about my day does matter. You will sometimes tell me that that's not okay, you can't do that. You will sometimes have a conversation with me about right and wrong and about what to expect from me, but it's not overly rigid. When that happens, that allows a child to develop what's called secure attachment style. Secure attachment styles that I have to you on the triangle page, going back to that. If anyone's interested more about this, one of the prolific writers on this topic is someone named Sue Johnson. She wrote a book called Love Sense. And what she writes is that secure, the optimal style, develops naturally when we grow up knowing that we can count on our main caregiver to be accessible and responsive to us. We learn to reach for closeness when we need it, trusting that we will be offered comfort and caring much of the time. This loving contact is a touchstone, helping us to calm ourselves and find our emotional balance. We feel comfortable with closeness and needing others. This is a typo on my end, I apologize. We aren't consumed by worry that we will be betrayed or abandoned. Our behavior says, in essence, I know I need you and you need me, and that's okay. In fact, it's great. So let's reach out to each other and get close. One of the things that she's hinting to here in attachment theory is that the ability to say that you need someone is very important, as opposed to the concept of self-sufficiency, where we look at having a need, having dependency on others as a bad thing. In attachment theory, the idea is that we are all dependent on one another. We all need people all the time. And being dependent is not a bad thing. It is actually what gives birth to relationships. And as we're talking about relationships, it is stuff of life. So someone with secure attachment style in the bullet points is comfortable in a warm, loving, and emotionally close relationship. They depend on a partner and allows a partner to depend on them. Is available for partner in times of needs. They accept the partner's needs for separateness without feeling rejected or threatened. They can be close and they can also be independent. They're trusting, empathetic, tolerant of differences, and forgiving. They communicate emotions and needs honestly and openly, and they're attuned to a partner's needs and respond appropriately. They do not avoid conflict. And I want to read for you one of my favorite depictions of... I'm sorry, if you have this stapled packet in front of you, you could take this home, and I hope you'll read the whole thing to yourselves. It's really beautiful. It's written by someone named Jay Lithvin. Called My Favorite Kind of Night. So this author, Jay, writes about his son. Dolby is one of those 9-year-old kids with tools scattered everywhere. He's got a vise attached to his desk for handy soldering and sleeps with a screwdriver and wires under his pillow, or at least tries to. You skip to the bottom. In short, Dolby is an active, independent, curious, funny 9-year-old boy who most evenings has to be called home from whatever adventure he's up to outside or at a friend's house. Turn the page over. That's why I was so surprised the other night overhearing a conversation between him and my wife. Dolby, are you going out tonight, Mommy? No, sweetie. Are you going to be home, he asked. Yes, she said. Good, he said. Pause. You have anything to do tonight, Mommy? No, she said. Good, he said. Why? Nothing, he said. I was just hoping you'd be home. You want me to do something with you tonight, she asked. No. Then why did you ask, she said. I was just hoping you'd be home. And? And sit on the couch and crochet, he said. That's it, she asked. Yup. That's all you want me to do, she asked. Yup. Just sit on the couch and crochet. Yup. He said, that's my favorite kind of night. And she did, crochet that is, propped up on our futon couch, feet crossed and dangling in her favorite faded, softest house coat as our son as happy as could be, puttering with his tools and wires, barely speaking to either of us until it was time for Mom and Dad to prod him into bed. She spent the evening just like Dolby wanted, quality time, Litvin style. Later, reflecting on what had occurred and talking with my wife about Dolby, I felt affirmed and vindicated. Skip to the next paragraph. To Dovi, it seems there is some magic, some essential element in the simple presence of his parents, something sense, something urgent and elemental that allows his independence and curiosity to flourish. Perhaps it's our availability, the knowledge that we are there if he needs us. Apparently, he likes it when we're only a yelp away. Who knows when a strange noise, dark shadow, or scary thought might frighten him. Despite his bravado, perhaps he's worried that he might burn himself with his soldering iron. What if, from some inner urging that I'll never understand, he suddenly chooses now as the time to talk with me or his mom about something important? A crisis at school, a problem with a friend, a dream from last night, a bad grade or deed that must suddenly be confessed. Who knows why for Dovi or any child, now is the best time for sharing rather than before or later, when we had or will have more time. Go to the bottom of the page. He wants us to be there, napping or reading or puttering with flowers or paying bills or talking on the phone or cutting grass or studying or doing just about anything, as long as we are seen and heard and can be counted on, just in case. Wants that magic, indescribable something that occurs between parent and child when they share the same time and space. He believes, and I agree, that in the security of our loving presence, he can conquer mountains, defeat armies, rule nations, author novels, write poems, manage large companies, compose concerts, design buildings, or solder two wires together on a Tuesday night so that a little light bulb lights up and affirms the conquest of his genius and perseverance. Just sit on the couch and crochet, Mommy, he says. It's my favorite kind of evening. And if you do, I'll traverse the heavens, discover the source of rainbows, search for angels in the dark, and learn to sing from the hollows of my heart until I fall asleep with my head in your lap. That's what it means to be in that sweet middle of being present, being available, and not overbearing, engaged, but not overengaged as if it was. A therapist I once did some training with, she told this story. She said when her child was a teenager, I'm speaking to parents of teenagers, teenagers don't do well with direct conversation. Yeah? Okay, I guess that's true. So she said what she used to do when her son was a teenager is she used to keep, like, a whole closet full of boxes of, I don't know why this was what it was, but pumpkin muffin mix in her kitchen. And late at night, she said it would be like once a week or so that she'd be cleaning up the kitchen after a whole day. And she'd just finished cleaning up everything and she'd be ready to go to bed or whatever it is. And she'd hear of her teenage son kind of coming down the stairs. So she'd quickly pull out a box of the pumpkin muffin mix. And just as he's walking in, she'd say to him, I was just about to start making pumpkin muffins. Would you keep me company? And he would just sit there as she made pumpkin muffins. And sometimes it would be nothing. Just a regular shooting the breeze. Sometimes it'd be no conversation. And once in a while, they'd get into real, personal, meaningful conversation. She said, years later, I think he was about 27, and he was dating someone very seriously. And one night, her son called her. And he's like, Mom, I forgot what the girl's friend's name was. I don't know. Sarah. Mom, I was just telling Sarah about the pumpkin muffins you were always making. And she's like, why was your mom always making pumpkin muffins? And then I realized, why was she always making pumpkin muffins? You weren't actually always about to make pumpkin muffins, right? And she said, yeah, you know, I wanted to be able to connect with you. And they were both crying on the phone. And he appreciated what it meant to really have a mother, to really have someone that was there, that wanted to have conversations with him, that was present, to really be there. don't know if anyone saw the U.S. Surgeon General study that came out maybe about close to a year ago. It's like an 80-90 page report, what they call the epidemic of loneliness in America. They describe how really extreme the loneliness has become in this country. They describe the health hazards and health effects of being lonely as being the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. The risk of stroke, of early onset dementia, of premature death goes up increasingly high when a person experiences loneliness. They describe that in 2003, a study that it showed that the average American citizen had 60 minutes a day of non-work-related social interactions. 60 minutes a day in 2003. In 2020, so more recently, just before COVID, and this is, I can't even imagine what it would be now. This is before COVID. In 2020, it went from 60 minutes in 2003 to 20 minutes a day in 2020. I don't know. Truth is, I think even 20 minutes sounds like a lot, which is scary. Does everyone have 20 minutes a day? Hey, I mean, this is a real thing. So we all know this. I haven't told you anything that you don't know. I don't think I've said anything that's what we'd call a kiddish, anything novel or insightful in a way you didn't know. The issue is that, do we really live with this? Are we really making this happen in our lives and in our children's lives? Not going to spend very much time on it, as I think probably, I don't know how long I've been going, I think it's probably close to ending. But all of that is the optimal of what we're striving for. I want to just very quickly, I'll run through it very quickly. I'm not going to go in depth. The other types of attachment styles that develop, just so you could be aware. If a child grows up in an environment where they don't get the things we just talked about, they don't receive that. So what happens is that subconsciously the inner system has a choice. I need connection. That's how we're wired, as we just described. We're hardwired that way. It's not like some people do, some people don't. We are hardwired to need connection. If I don't get that connection, so I'm going to be in pain. I'm going to be suffering. So my system has two choices. Either double down on the efforts to get that connection, or shut off the system and stop experiencing the desire for connection. Those two options develop into two different attachment styles that are what's called either anxious attachment style, which is the desire to pursue the relationships more. I'm not getting what my needs are, so I'm going to pursue them more. I'm going to assume it's my fault that I'm not getting the attention, the love, the connection that I need. It's my fault that it's not happening, so I'm going to go after it more furiously. I'm going to double down on that. That's going to show up in people who are a lot more relationally needy, clingy, etc. And then you're going to have the opposite, which is people who develop what's called avoidant attachment style, where you become avoidant, you shut off the system. So just two quick, easy examples of this. Someone walks in the room and their friend says to them, "Hey, I like your shirt." So the anxious attachment style person will say, "Really, you like it?" The avoidant attachment style person will say, "This old thing, that is nothing." Or, "Yeah, I always look good, of course," right? The secure attachment style person will say, "Thank you. I was actually really excited to wear it. I also like it," right? One example. Second example, couples get into arguments. Yeah, that's a normal thing to happen. You know, you get into a fight. So there's classic marriage advice. Don't go to sleep in a fight. Heard that? Good. It's the worst advice ever tell anyone. If you're in a fight and you're married, go to sleep. It's the best thing you can do. However, here's the key. Anxious attachment style people will not go to sleep in a fight. They will keep going at it because I can't tolerate the distress and the dis-ease of not having the connection. And my way of responding to that dis-ease is to go after it more furiously. So I can't go to sleep. I can't back off. I can't regulate. The avoided detachment person will stonewall, will check out. They will go to sleep, and they will never talk about it again when they wake up. That's what the avoidant will do, right? The secure attachment style that we're striving for will go to sleep, and then when we feel more regulated about it, we're in a better place to talk about it, we will then intentionally reopen the conversation. So that's in marriage, adult relationships. In our children, these attachment styles will play out in a variety of ways that I think are very important to be aware of. I'm not going to start listing all of them now. I think I've been going for long enough. But I will just say that to be aware of these different attachment styles can be game-changing. And the way that we can work with them as parents is as follows. If there's a child who's avoidant attachment style, they socially isolate, they shut off, they won't talk about issues, they won't express needs or wants or feelings to anyone. If it's extreme, they're probably going to need a little bit more help than what I'm about to tell you. Similarly, if they are anxious in the way that there's a constant anxiety around reassurance, they're also going to probably need a little bit more help than I'm about to tell you. However, is a spectrum. So if it's not either extreme, but it's somewhere in the middle, but we want to help our children get to a little bit more of a secure attachment place, then what we want to do is we want to be aware of the child's attachment style. That's the very first thing. Well, the very first thing is be aware of your own attachment style. Because the best thing you can do for your child is to get yourself more towards secure attachment. Because if you're able to be regulated in the relationship, we all co-regulate, we have mirror neuron, but co-regulation, the more that you're in a regulated place, the more that that energetically and logically creates regulation in the people around you. So the first thing you can do is actually know your own attachment style and bring yourself closer to secure attachment style. Then if you can identify and know your child's attachment style as being more on the anxious side or more on the avoidant side, what you want to do is move it over a tiny inch at a time. Tiny, not a lot. If you have a child that doesn't like going to social events and you hear that the grade's having an event, the school's doing an event, you're not going to help your child by saying, come on, you can go, you're going to have the best time. That's not going to help them. If they're anxious and you tell them, come on, it's fine, there's nothing to worry about, that's not going to help them. The way that we can help them is with tiny movements, the smallest movement at a time. Because this is not about, you know, I could just be told it's okay or not okay. This is about actually feeling a lack of safety. And if I feel a lack of safety, mostly subconsciously, then being told that, oh, it's just going to be okay. Come on, just go do it. Just come, just one time, do it for me. That's not going to help someone feel more safe. So there's a lot more to say on how we can work with that. God willing, I hope I'll be back and we can do this again. And I just really, though, want to come full circle to where I started, which is to say that this community has just been just really so gracious. The way that I've experienced all your children in the past few days makes me feel really confident that you actually don't need the second half of my talk and how to work with insecure attachment styles, because I think your children seem like gems. And this community is a gem. And I think Gary Block and the whole Shalhevet faculty and staff and parent body and all the students for giving me such an uplifting and inspirational experience. Thank you so much for your listening and for your eager eyes and faces of taking this in. And I hope that with God's help, we can all provide ourselves, each other, and our children with that nurturing, beautiful type of attachment that can help all of us fulfill our fullest potential together in a shared experience. Thank you.
It's like does Rabbi Dan and the Sadhguru
sure.
And continuously.
What does he do? Very quickly, before we wrap up.
Yeah, this about any one thing. We're showing first, and
you're very. That's not enough. I thank Rabbi Shal Helden to actually. I do have a lot of questions, but I'm trying to.
Appreciate. Thank you so much. I'm big data. Thank you. I did. I will mention. I wrote a book on attachment theory and its application for how we can develop our attachment with the higher power, with God. I take all of these ideas and I repurpose them. They were developed in the context of interpersonal relationships. What I tried to do is to take these ideas and repurpose them for how we can create a relationship with the divide. The book is called Attached. There are a number of copies outside for sale if anyone's interested. And the podcast that I do revolves around these types of ideas as well, how we can deepen relationships with ourselves, with each other, and with God. The podcast is also called Attached. There are brochures outside that have like QR code and all the information. It's on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all those good things. And all of that is on the tables outside. Thank you again, really. Thank you so much.
As you just said, that's just thinking shall have it, but you should have seen, I see your faces right now is exactly your kids' faces for the past 3 days, just walking out of rooms like, Rabbi, I don't know how you shall have it choose to spend the money, but that was money well spent. So, the line they have think, and it's just seeing from Wednesday, literally till this moment right now, through Shabbos, in the community, with the kids, the lights that was like coming out of each child walking out of, and it wasn't just that you did a night seder. It's the Gemara. If any of your kids were at night seder, ask them how night seder was. It was, so Eliza asked Eliza right after, and she said, that was so much, but you know, so, no, it was really a special, experience, a weekend in Bezrat Hashem to many more. As Rabbi Danishevsky said, there's a podcast, there's a brochures kind of like on the tables outside with the link to subscribe to the podcast. There's also books on the table out there. It has also something that you could buy them right there and buy a book right here. Billy Salaf, the Rebbe Shimon will, you can definitely order more to Los Angeles. But I also just want to take out the opportunity with Davishevsky, the thing, and put an amazing weekend, amazing week and weekend. It was truly tremendous learning with you, learning from you, and growing with you. So thank you so much for coming out. Thank you to Rabbi Falk for putting this together. And thank you guys for an amazing Malab and Malcolm.
Before I have looking at the number.
So.
It's all you know, what's it?
Hey, on over.
Right.
So much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please follow us on WhatsApp, YouTube, or Instagram. All our podcast series can be found wherever you listen to podcasts. I'd love to hear from you, so please reach out with questions, comments, or suggestions, or to be added to our WhatsApp groups. You can reach us through email using yakov.attached@gmail.com or on WhatsApp at 773-888-2413.